Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. And our poor President George W. Bush, he really doesn't want you to have watched the debate last night, the third and final presidential debate between George W. Bush and John Kerry. He's already talking about how he's so glad to be out on the campaign trail, and no wonder. George Bush is 3 for 3. Strike one, strike two, strike three, he's out. The American people have said by overwhelming, surprising margins that John Kerry won all three debates. Now, I don't know if you agree with that. I don't know if you agree with the majority of Americans. Or are you one of those rare individuals, hard to find, that actually believes that George W. Bush won the debate? I want to hear from you. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can contribute to the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. What was it about the debate that most struck you? What did you think Kerry did the best? What did he do worse? Some of you believe Kerry won, but are criticizing some of the things he did. What was it that George Bush did or did not do well? Later on in the broadcast, we're going to have a professor from the University of Chicago. He's an economics professor, Professor Auton Goolsbee. And he'll be able to tell us about some of these numbers that the candidates were throwing around, jobs numbers and the cost of living and all those things. And he'll be able to give us some true economic insight into what George Bush has wrought. How much of this economy in the last 4 years is George W. Bush's fault? What can John Kerry do in the future to promote jobs? But first, got to go over the numbers. In the first debate, John Kerry beat George Bush by some 15 points, 52-37%, that later increased over time as people talk with their friends about what really happened, to 57-25, an astonishing 32-point margin. The second debate, John Kerry won by, in some polls, a 2-point margin, up to other polls, a 15-point margin. And in last night's debate, the polls show that John Kerry won by a 13-point margin. Oh, and don't believe the ABC poll. The ABC poll showed that John Kerry only won by 1 point, but in that poll, they had 8% more Republicans than Democrats. So in a poll weighted toward the Republicans, right, where you've got 38-30% Republicans over Democrats, John Kerry is still the victor. That's pretty solid. And that's shown by the fact that undecided voters voted for Kerry over Bush in the last debate by 39-25%. So Kerry clearly won all three debates. And I have to say, I think that is pretty surprising. I mean, here you have a country more divided than really it's ever been before, certainly in my lifetime. You got the red states, you got the blue states, you have really an anger between those who want 4 more years of George W. Bush and those of us that think that nothing worse could happen in America. And yet, all the American people can agree by overwhelming numbers, huge numbers, that John Kerry won all three debates. So what is it? What caused John Kerry to win the three debates? Is it that John Kerry was so good, or George W. Bush was so bad, or some combination of both? I have to crow also about some other numbers. On Tuesday this week, on Election Tuesday, when I debate Republicans, we had Tom Robbins. He's the state chair of the Utah College Republicans, and he was insisting that young people were for Bush, or were at least evenly split. I insisted that the polls I'd seen had shown at least a 15-point margin for Kerry over Bush among young people. Well, not only is Tom Robbins wrong, he's dead wrong. Latest poll by The Economist shows young people aged 18-24 prefer John Kerry 63-34%, almost a 2-to-1 margin, 30% more, a 30-point margin for young people aged 18-24. And that's why when you look at these polls, when they look at likely voters, what do they look at? They say, have you voted before? And of course, young people aged 18-24 haven't, so they're not included in these surveys that show George Bush way ahead. Young people overwhelmingly for John Kerry, and I think you'll see if they go out and vote, and of course, whether people come out or vote or not makes all the difference in the election, that will make the difference. Young people will put John Kerry over the top. Another interesting thing in the Economist poll is that of all Americans, they consider North Korea the greatest threat facing us. Iran is second. Iraq is a distant third. So what are we doing in Iraq? I still don't know. Again, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. There's so many things to talk about in the debate last night. We can talk about everything from Dick Cheney complaining that in a discussion of gay marriage, John Kerry raised the fact that his daughter's gay. We can talk about John Kerry's very solid answer on assault weapons that I was very impressed with. Or both candidates' discussion of immigration. Only one question, kind of short. Then there was the detailed health plan that John Kerry put forward. People who wanted details in the plans, they got it. Or there's the fact that they both talked about their wives, and John Kerry made a nice joke about his that I thought really served to humanize him. How about their conclusions? John Kerry's solid conclusion. Do you think Bush was making faces? I saw some. I don't think it was as bad as the first debate, but George Bush really doesn't seem to like it when people attack him, when they attack his policies. I don't think he's used to hearing people attack his policies. There's the fact that John Kerry pointed out the two education systems we live in, one for the wealthy and one for the poor. And then what's this controversy about some bulge, some bulk, some hidden device behind George Bush's shoulder blades? People have been dismissing it at the outset, but now more and more people are looking at the pictures, first shown on Salon.com and other bloggers across the web, and it sure looks like George Bush had a listening device. Of the 25% of Americans who had seen the picture, half, 49%, believe that George Bush indeed had a listening device. And whether he had it or not, what does it say? What does it say that we believe that our president is having a listening device? What does it say about our belief that George Bush knows what he's talking about, or whether his advisors are pulling the strings? At the same time, Jim Bunning, running for Senate from Kentucky, a guy way ahead. This was a race that no one thought would be any challenge at all. Jim Bunning was well ahead in the polls. Kentucky's a very conservative state these days. He was caught using a teleprompter. He wouldn't appear in the same room in Lexington, Kentucky as his challenger. He was in Washington. Very few people were allowed in with him, and he was caught reading from a teleprompter. So for all the people who say, oh, well, what a conspiracy, I can't believe that Bush has a listening device, well, we got another Republican caught using a teleprompter, and I got to say, Kentucky race may be a lot closer after all. By the way, we're going to have the author of that piece, the first person to point out that strange device between George Bush's shoulder blades. His name's Dave Lindorf. He is the first contributor to Salon.com to really point it out. He's coming here on the Inside Scoop this Sunday. We're going to talk about that and all kinds of other Republican dirty tricks that are going on, including votes being thrown away already in Nevada and Arizona, where you've got groups registering people to vote, and if they register Democrat, they get thrown in the trash. We'll be talking all about that on Sunday. And tomorrow's broadcast you'll want to hear, too. We're going to talk about Sinclair Broadcasting, the pro-Republican organization, giving hundreds of thousands to Republicans, getting some stuff back, too. We're going to talk about all the advantages they're getting back from the Bush administration and why it is that they're preempting regular programming right before the election to run an anti-Kerry screed, again attacking him for what he did in the Vietnam War. No one, of course, is talking about George Bush and the fact that his cocaine use kept him from flying in the National Guard, grounded him. All the evidence points to it, but no one's talking about that. So there's a lot to talk about. We've got a Sinclair boycott tomorrow. We've got the dirty tricks on Sunday. But today, I want to talk about the debates. And I want to find out from you what you thought was most persuasive, what you thought was least persuasive. I want to read some of the comments on the blog. We got a comment here by Gordon of Michigan. And he writes, if Bush's sneer gets any more crooked, it's going to slide right off his face. He's herky-jerky in his mannerisms. He looks more and more like a loser when he matches up on the same stage with Kerry, who looks composed in comparison. Gordon, I agree with you. I think that's exactly right. George Bush, as much as he tried to prevent the sneer that showed up in debate one, it sure came back in debate three. Did you see it? Did you see that strange grin where he's like struggling not to frown? This is a guy who really can't handle bad news. He's so surrounded by people who agree with him, whether it's his campaign where he makes people sign loyalty oaths and where only Bush supporters can get in, or whether it's his advisors who don't dare tell him what he doesn't want to hear. If he says Saddam is connected to 9/11 and Richard Clark says it wasn't, he sends Richard Clark right back out again to find the proof that doesn't exist. When you have a president surrounded by yes-men, it's very unlikely that he's going to find out anything about what's going on. Interestingly enough, Saddam Hussein suffered from the same problem. Saddam Hussein was so surrounded by yes-men that when we invaded his country, he didn't believe it was happening. Similarly, George Bush is so surrounded by yes-men that when we didn't find weapons of mass destruction, he didn't believe it was happening. So, that's part of the problem. And now, when John Kerry's actually confronting him, I think that's the cause of the sneer. Gordon, he just can't help himself. James points out that Kerry missed a chance to really slam dunk the president. James writes on the question about flu shots, the president had the nerve to suggest they might get more flu vaccine from Canada. Kerry's response should have been, "I find it telling that the president is willing to get vaccine from Canada, but he is not willing to let you buy drugs from Canada. The president is clearly not fighting for you." Actually, I agree with you, James. I noticed on the flu question, too, I thought Kerry could have done a better job. I thought he was solid throughout, but on that particular one, I said, no, Kerry, answer the question. I shouted out to the TV set, answer the question about the flu shots, because you're absolutely right, James. It's striking, again, that the president is saying, oh, maybe we'll get flu shots from Canada, but it is forbidden under law for you to get any other drugs from Canada that are cheaper, even drugs by American companies that are being sold to Canada and re-imported back to the United States. We talked a lot about that yesterday. It's a very strong point. And I think there's another point, James, that I wish Kerry had made about the flu shots. It just shows incompetence, bad planning on the part of the United States government, that we used half of our supply from one company. You know, if you're investing in the stock market, people would tell you it's a really silly mistake to put all your eggs in one basket, to invest everything you own in Enron or any other company for that matter. You should diversify. The same is true with our health system. We shouldn't use one company for half of all our flu shots. We should have diversified. It's a basic understanding of how you do stuff, right? I mean, it's a risk management tool. Bush didn't do that. And you got to remember, 36,000 people die of the flu every year. And that's a huge number. And, of course, many of them are old and are dying anyway. It's still a very huge number. It's 12 times the number murdered on September 11th. And how many more will die because of George Bush's incompetence? And I think you're absolutely right, James. It was a solid point, and Kerry should have brought it up more. DHG writes that Kerry failed to expose anything about how corrupt the Bush administration is, owned by special interests, primarily the drug and insurance companies. You know, DHG, I think Kerry did point that out. Maybe he could have done a better job, but I think he did point out how much Bush is providing for the special interests, for the rich and the powerful, and not enough for you and me. DHG writes on the question of minimum wage, Bush ducked that completely, no concern for the working poor, and Kerry let him get away with that too. Kerry won all the debates pretty clearly, but he appears not to have a clue as to how criminal our present White House crew is, or for some other reason doesn't want to expose it. Well, I don't know that I agree with you there, DHG. I think the American people understood that John Kerry was for raising the minimum wage, and George Bush was dancing around the question. The same is true about the question of Supreme Court justice and whether George Bush would overturn Roe v. Wade. Kerry made clear that our constitutional rights should stand, and George Bush said, well, you know, basically I'm not telling you. I think people see that, and I don't know that Kerry had to hit it home. Maybe he should have. Maybe he should have hit it a little more clearly. But see, what's interesting to me in these debates is that John Kerry is really reaching out to the middle. If he calls the White House criminal, if he uses those words that you use, DHG, then I think he loses the middle, even though many of us believe it's true. But George Bush is reaching out to the right-wing conservatives. He's a guy that is working to get his base. And what does it say about the two candidates? That John Kerry is reaching out toward the middle, and George Bush, well, he only wants to increase his base. And again, whatever you think about the debates, I think at the end of the day, you got to reach out to the middle. We have a very divided country. And again, John Kerry's reaching it. George Bush isn't. We got to go to a commercial break. When I come back, I'm going to have Dr. Goolsbee, Professor Auten Goolsbee, economist from the University of Chicago, on the air to talk about some of the economic claims of both the candidates. And I'm going to ask him how we live in an economy where costs are going up and wages are going down. Is some of that the fault of George W. Bush? Or, as Bush claims, is it just the business cycle? Is it just a mere coincidence that George Bush is the first president since the Great Depression to lose jobs under his watch? Don't believe me. Professor Goolsbee is an economist at a very prestigious school, University of Chicago, and he's going to let us know whether maybe George Bush's policies are part of the reason why we've been in such an economic slump. If you want to call in and talk about this or anything else in last night's debate, your calls are always welcome. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can always contribute to the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after these messages.
With the election looming, George W. is back to claiming that he's a compassionate conservative. And as evidence, he cites his centerpiece education law, the No Child Left Behind Act. This is supposed to be a tough love reform, compelling all public school kids to pass standardized tests. If the kids fail the federal government's strict tests, they'll be held back, and their schools can lose federal funding and be replaced by corporate-run chain schools. But instead of tough love, Bush's law actually is a tough luck scam, for he has callously refused to fund the reform part. To get Congress to approve the law, he had agreed to put up tax dollars for smaller classes, special teachers, tutors, educational equipment, and other resources needed for schools to improve the ability of our kids to learn and pass Bush's tests. He reneged. In this year's presidential budget proposal, George shorts his own No Child Left Behind reform by $9 billion. That's on top of $17 billion he withheld in his previous two budgets. In fact, this spring, Bush offered more of our tax dollars in the form of a bribe to try to get the government of Turkey to send some troops to Iraq than he has offered to all of America's school districts to implement his federally mandated education law. By so severely shortchanging our public schools, the Bushites can advance their ideological agenda of school privatization. As more and more schools lack the resources to achieve the passing rates required on the mandated tests, a little-known provision in Georgia's law will kick in, one that encourages states to privatize schools that fail his testing system. This is Jim Hightower saying, lest you assume that private schools will be better, thus more compassionate, recent data from Bush's own education department now reveals that children in such schools are doing worse academically than those who are in our public system. George's reform is not about compassion. It's about profits.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror. My wife's still in bed. And this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. We're talking about the debates last night, and there's so many things to talk about. There are all the domestic issues and health care. I thought John Kerry gave a very detailed health care plan. There's immigration. There's the comments about their wives. There is the assault weapons, which, I thought Kerry did very well on that. There is the fact that John Kerry I thought was much more compassionate to gay people than George W. Bush, though Dick Cheney is very upset by mentioning his daughter that's gay. What do you think about that? Toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or as so many of you have done, you can contribute to the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. I want to turn to my guest today because his name is Professor Alton Goolsbee. He's a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, and there are a lot of economic things being thrown around between the two of them, and I want to hear from an economist as to, well, who's right? Who's wrong? Are the parties exaggerating the numbers? So I want to welcome Professor Goolsbee to the Inside Scoop. How are you, sir?
Hi, how you doing, Mark?
I'm good. Let me deal with some of the economic claims that they're throwing around back and forth. Is it true that, indeed, while costs are going up, wages are going down in America?
Well, it is true, and you got to be very careful about that particular statistic because what the administration wants to quote is the average, and what the Democrats have been quoting is the middle.
Okay.
So if you take the median, it's definitely going down. Real incomes, disposable income, any way you measure it, people in the middle, it's getting worse.
Well, I was an economics major, and I remember one of the first classes talking about statistics, the difference between the average and the median or the middle.
Right.
And of course, the middle family is the family where half of all families are doing better and half of all families are doing worse.
Right.
The
so
average,
it's like the middle class person.
Exactly.
They're doing worse.
But the average family, what you do with average is you take everyone's income and you pile it together and then you divide. So
right.
In other words, if four of us in the room have a dollar and Bill Gates is in the room with $1 billion,
right.
Each
the
of
average
us...
average is something real high.
Yeah. We're on average, we each have $200 million.
Right. Okay. But, so that's what... that's exactly why this thing has been so misleading. They keep quoting, the administration keeps quoting the number that real disposable income is up by 2%. But the thing that's misleading about that is that's all because they had a huge tax cut at the very top of the income distribution. So the disposable income for those guys went way, way, way up, and the disposable income for everybody else below that is going down modestly.
Let me ask you this, Professor Goolsbee. As an economist, there must be some record that shows the distribution of income when the rich are getting richer and the
yep.
poor are getting poorer. What records do you use to measure that, and how's that, I mean, under the Bush administration, have incomes come closer together or farther apart?
The incomes have definitely gone farther apart. They usually measure this with the current population survey put out by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It comes out every year, and in some years more than it comes out every month. Now, that it's not like Bush is unusual in that sense. For the last 25 years, there has been a trend toward greater income inequality.
Even during the Clinton years?
Even during the Clinton years.
Okay.
The thing that was different, and that's, to be fair, that's not caused by anything the president does. There's this underlying trend. A lot of people think it's because of the increase in computers, use of computers in businesses. So there's an increasing gap between the wages that skilled workers are getting and unskilled workers are getting. And that's kind of the root of why this inequality is growing.
But does the tax cut make it worse?
Okay, now that's the thing, is the trend is quite separate from, well, then what do you do on top of this trend? And what Clinton did was to say, well, let's try to use the tax code to work against the trend. So you say, okay, the people who've been hurt the most, let's give them a little bit of relief, give an earned income tax credit, middle class tax relief. What George Bush has done is the opposite. You say, okay, the trend is heavily toward guys at the top. It's been a fantastic 10 or 15 years for them. Let's give them even more with the tax code and just pile the thing on.
Now, here's some numbers that I don't have in front of me. I don't know if you have in front of you at all, but I've always been struck by the difference in wages between CEOs of major corporations and the lowest paid workers. And I've seen it go up from like 10 times to 50 times. Do you have those numbers?
I don't have those in front of me, but I am familiar with that. Now, again, I think we want to be fair. That is not caused by anything the president did. Those trends have been going, and they exist. Those trends exist in other countries, though our levels are bigger. Of the discrepancy between the top and the bottom are bigger here than other places. It's growing everywhere. The question is, given that's what's happening, how does the government respond to that? And there, I think you can make a case that the administration has maybe not been doing what's in the minds of the, you know, the middle class voters.
Well, let me throw out to you, I mean, I get conservative callers, they call on this broadcast, and they say things like, well, you know, tax cuts to the rich, they promote the economy, and that's, even if you call it trickle-down economics, that's just a pejorative term, it's a negative term, but actually, if you give tax cuts to the people at the very top, then they'll give jobs to people in the middle and the poor, and we'll all be better off. And I keep making the argument on this program that, you know what, if you give tax cuts to the middle class and the poor, they're more likely to spend the money rather than saving it. And if you got a car factory, you're more likely to build another car factory. If you got a lot of people wanting cars, then giving $100 million to someone at the top who probably already has 7 Rolls Royces. Now, we've had this debate several times on the program. I'm going to ask you, am I right? Are they right? Are we both right? What's going on?
Well, economists who look at this subject tend to view all of those indirect spillover effects, let's say the down-the-road effects, either of cutting the taxes for the top guys or at the middle, to be pretty much smaller than the direct effects. Okay, so that's why I have been saying if your main goal is to create jobs, the more sensible thing to do is to design a tax credit for job creation. Or if you think manufacturing's had a hard time, the best way to help manufacturing is to design programs directly intended to affect manufacturing. I think the evidence is pretty clear. The evidence is very clear that if you just cut taxes for very wealthy people, in no way do they generate their own revenue. They don't increase growth enough to make up for the loss of tax revenue that you get by making the tax rates lower. So that part of the trickle-down theory, it just doesn't work. Now, we don't have as much experience with major tax cuts just in the middle, so we can't say for sure what would be the ultimate spillover effect on the economy. But I still think you're much better off aiming for the direct impact of the taxes.
Okay,
and Kerry has proposed, you know, in fairness, Kerry's tax proposals center on things like that. He says, hey, rather than give a major windfall to very rich people in the hope that a few of them would become small business job creators, let's just make a direct credit for far less money that encourages job creation. And that seems very sensible to me.
Well, one of the things I've noticed is that Bush crows about the fact that after losing 3 million jobs, he got 2 million of them back. That kind of reminds me of the gambler that says, I'm up. I lost $3,000 and I'm up 2,000 more. So, you know, I've only lost $1,000. Look, look at the 2,000 I just won. Gambler, what about the 3,000 you lost? Shh, don't talk about that.
Right.
Let's talk about the 2,000. But apart from that, I've noticed that even the 2 million jobs created that might let Bush break even, though I doubt it before he leaves office, that the cost of that 2 million is some 10 trillion in our deficit. I mean, that he took us from a $5 trillion projected deficit over the next 10 years to close to a $5 trillion deficit over the next 10 years.
Surplus. I absolutely agree with that.
So you got $10 trillion
going on. Let me just make my point.
Just 1 second. If you take 10 trillion and you divide by the 2 million jobs, I did a calculation, that's $5 million per job. I'll bet we could get a job without paying $5 million a person.
Okay,
but go ahead, make your point.
True, but the thing is, you got two things going on here. In it, you weren't just running up the deficit in order to increase jobs, obviously.
You were
getting national defense along with it. You were getting whatever things they were spending money on.
Right.
The two things you got going on are, and we probably should talk more specifically about this deficit thing. There, I believe you can pin virtually all of the decline in our fiscal situation on the actions taken by the president. There is a small share, and he tried to say, look, we had a recession, we had a war, that was the problem. The Congressional Budget Office has analyzed that. That was not the problem. That is only about one-fifth of the deficit. Fully two-thirds of the deficit came just from the tax cut.
Well, now that's really important, and because I get callers all the time that say, oh, well, the reason we have this huge deficit is because of 9/11, because of the fight in the war. You're saying that two-thirds of our deficit is caused solely by George Bush's tax cut.
Yes, and it's not just me. This is not my opinion. This is the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, and if anything, has been leaning toward the Republicans. They analyze it. I mean, we can just add this up. We know from past experience what is the impact of recession on our tax revenue. And so you can just take that part out. And it's only about 20 to 25% of our deficit from this year. It can be explained by those things. Two-thirds of it came from the tax cut. And as you look out in the future, the number gets even bigger because a lot of the Bush tax cuts are backloaded. So it's the estate tax gets fully repealed several years down the road, and that's going to be very costly. And that's all from the tax cut. The recession's over by that point, so you can't pin that on 9/11. You can't pin that on the recession.
No, and in fact, we Democrats, when I was working in Congress, we very much wanted a temporary tax cut,
right,
to sort of front load it, get us out of the recession,
right,
but wouldn't lead us to these huge, huge deficits that we have to pay back in the future. I want to go to the phones. If you want to call in, the toll free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Professor Goolsbee.
Dave, on the internet and becoming a big fan of your program.
Thank you, Dave.
Professor Goolsbee, I see you as a very intelligent and decent man wanting to be fair, but I think to look at it honestly, this is a very willful, evil plan that we're the victims of, I believe. It began with this PNAC group, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Cheney. Their plan was to break the middle class, to outsource as much of jobs as possible, to import cheap labor, to put the working poor in a position where they had no power to negotiate with the owner class, so that the wealth would more and more funnel to the very rich and let these eagles soar, as the song goes. Huh? And it's a very deliberate thing. Like, Social Security was going to be good for the next 37 years when Clinton and Gore left. They had put in a big surplus, and Bush has just stolen that to give more of that to his very rich cronies, along with illegal contracts and everything. We have a most criminal, psychopathic group occupying our White House, and to think of it as inept decisions rather than willful criminal behavior, I think, is to not see the reality of what we're up against.
Well, let me pass the question on to Professor Goolsbee. I think there are two parts to Dave's statement. One, are the facts which he cites correct about Social Security and how, you know, the poor are getting poorer and the middle class is shrinking? And second, the much more explosive point he makes, that this may be deliberate rather than incompetence. Professor Goolsbee?
Okay, so the second one, I don't know anything about the inner workings of the, you know, various groups. As regards to Social Security, it is true that if you add up what's the deficit of the current Social Security system for the next 75 years, it's about $3.7 trillion. And we had surpluses at the end of the Clinton administration of over $5 trillion. And it was the Clinton administration view, if you remember, their thing was save Social Security first. And they said, let's take this surplus and let's use it to make the Social Security system stable. So we essentially have that problem solved, at least for 75 years, which is a long time. And when Bush takes office, at the moment he takes office, the surplus is still in excess. Like I say, the surplus was more than $5 trillion, and the Social Security deficit was $3.7 trillion. So they said, okay, well, let's have a tax cut of the difference, because we don't want Washington to spend that extra money.
You're talking about the Bush plan originally.
Yeah, the original Bush plan,
okay,
circa 2001.
Okay.
Very rapidly it becomes clear that we're not going to actually develop $5 trillion of surplus. But they don't back off the tax cut. They press ahead with it. They then press ahead a second one and press ahead a third one. So it is true that they cut taxes, and that eliminated something like two-thirds. That did about two-thirds of the fiscal damage that has been done.
You know,
and you could certainly make a viable argument that we had the Social Security problem solved, and now we got rid of it. So that was why I objected a little. I thought Bush politically did a good job in answering the Social Security question, because he said, look, our current system is in crisis. And even though Kerry's saying that to have these private accounts is going to make things worse, he kind of pinned it on Kerry and said, well, what's your plan? You don't have any plan to save the system.
And I've seen a pattern here. It's Bush messes it up and then says, Kerry, how are you going to fix this?
It is a little bit of that.
I mean, whether it's Social Security, whether it's Iraq.
Well, we had it solved before, and everybody kind of said, no, that's not true. But we did kind of have it solved before. We had the money if we wanted to spend it on that.
Now, Dave, of course, believes it's more than just incompetence, that it's a deliberate plot to help some of Bush's rich friends, and certainly some of his rich friends have been aided. Dave and I have discussed this before. I guess my view is it doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter, but at the end of the day, if we want to get this guy out, we've got to reach out to the middle, and the middle's never going to believe it was a deliberate criminal plot.
The thing is, I would view myself as more in the middle, and so I do find it hard to believe that there was a conspiracy or, you know, that they were out to wreck the country. But, I mean, it's certainly I can appreciate where the caller's coming from.
Maybe I'm somewhere in between the two of you. My view is that while Bush didn't deliberately intend to wreck the country, that he did intend to help out his rich friends and in the process didn't care about the fact that it would hurt the middle class and hurt the poor. So while his intention wasn't to destroy the poor, it was, well, if they get destroyed, that's not really my concern. So I guess I'm in between both of you. Hey, thanks very much for your call, Dave. I appreciate
it. Thank
you. All right, we've got to go to commercial break. When we come back, there are a number of issues to discuss. There are the economic issues we can discuss with Professor Goolsbee, and a number of you have written in on the blog on all kinds of issues, the environment, the mention by Kerry about Dick Cheney's daughter. Some of you think that's okay. Some of you don't. The Supreme Court, there's lots to talk about. All you have to do is call toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or just keep commenting on the blog. We'll be reading some of your blog comments right after this.
Governor Jeb Bush is out to make his state of Florida the next Florida. In 2000, Jeb used such crude political tactics as illegally purging voter lists to help engineer his brother's 537-vote victory in that election. And now, here he goes again. As one peer of Florida's GOP establishment candidly puts it, a Democrat can't win a statewide election in Florida without a high turnout of African Americans. It's no secret that the name of the game for Republicans is to restrain that turnout as much as possible. The Orlando League of Voters can attest to that. This African-American civic group has played a big role in turning Orlando from a Republican stronghold into a city that increasingly votes Democratic. Their reward for getting involved in the Democratic process is to have Jeb Bush's state police suddenly come knock, knock, knocking on the doors of some 50 of the League's grassroots leaders. These leaders, mostly elderly black women, find it frightening to be confronted in their homes by armed troopers interrogating them about their electoral participation. They're not charged with any crime. Instead, police say they're investigating vague allegations that some voter fraud might have occurred in this spring's mayoral election. Yet Jeb's own state police honcho wrote in a May letter that, quote, there was no basis to support the allegations, and he declared this matter closed. But it has not closed. Police now say the chief's letter was poorly worded, and the intimidating in-home interrogations continued this summer as the presidential election heated up. Jeb's police action is creating a blanket of fear among the League's volunteers who worry that their perfectly legal efforts will land them in jail. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course Jeb says that there's no political motive involved, but when asked how long the Orlando investigation will go on, police say it might continue right through November 2nd.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first 6 payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, "We eliminate the middleman"? Well, one thing's pretty certain. It wasn't the middleman. And how did they eliminate him? Something fishy there. But I digress. GEICO pioneered direct-to-consumer car insurance over 65 years ago, and they've been saving smart drivers money ever since. Give them a call, and you might ask them, what did they do with the middleman?
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. We're talking about the debate that happened last night between John Kerry and George Bush, and my guest, Professor Auden Goolsbee, is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, and we're going to talking with him about the numbers that the candidates throw around and, well, how much of the economy really is Bush's fault, how much is Kerry's fault. If you want to call in, well, none of it's Kerry's fault yet. But anyway, if you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or many of you have already contributed to the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com, and I'm going to read some of what you said right now. The first comment is from Vince. Vince writes, "The first 5 or 10 minutes of the debate, I thought I was watching one of the previous debates, almost word for word, both guys." Actually, Vince, I agree with you about the first 5 or 10 minutes. That went back to the old foreign policy part where, again, John Kerry just won't admit what the Republicans say he means. The Republicans say that he wants basically France to have a veto over our national security. It's completely untrue. John Kerry has made it clear that it's untrue, but they're going to keep saying it in the hope that someone believes it. Actually, Kerry's global test, which George Bush really wants to talk about. What was it, if you heard it, in the first debate? Or was it the second? I think it was the first. In any case, his test was that what we do should be seen as reasonable to Americans and to the rest of the world. If you're against Kerry's global test, you think we should act even if it's unreasonable and seen as unreasonable. That's a pretty strong test. All he's saying is that what we do, we should be able to explain to the world why we're doing it. I don't think it's much of a test, but I think it is a reasonable one. Vince goes on to say, "I did think Kerry missed, or misses, some great opportunities to rebut. Drugs from Canada, how Bush is going to pay for anything. I don't think Bush ever addresses that." Well, actually, John Kerry did say last night that for Bush to charge Kerry with spending too much is kind of like Tony Soprano complaining about crime. George Bush is a massive spender. I think Kerry got that across, but perhaps he could have gotten it across a little bit more. I want to turn to our economist here, Professor Goolsbee. You talked about George Bush increasing the deficit through his tax cut, some two-thirds of it, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. Is it also true that George Bush is spending more than his predecessor, Bill Clinton?
It's very clear. If you look at the data, you can just look at the national accounts data. Spending's growing as fast as it's grown in the last 50 years. Now, part of that, for sure, is defense-related. But even if you look at the non-defense part, I think the president got a little confused at one point.
You're putting it so nicely, but
well,
go ahead.
At one point in the previous debate, he said, when I took office, discretionary non-defense spending was growing at 15% or something, and now it's only growing at 1%. And what he got confused was that was his he promised to limit the spending to 1%, but in fact the spending is growing more like 10% a year, which is faster than all but one of the years under Clinton and among the fastest rates of the last 4 or 5 decades.
So let's get this straight. Bush promises to increase it 1%. It actually increases 10%, worse than 7 out of 8 Clinton years. And George Bush just forgot that his promise didn't occur. And in fact, he's spending it 10 times that rate. oops, he thought what occurred was what he promised, but he didn't happen to notice what actually occurred.
Yeah, maybe something like that.
All right, okay. I just think you're being awfully generous to the president, but fair enough. Maybe, you know, maybe he just says what his advisors tell him to say.
I think what it is you get in the, they're on the spot, and he's got a whole bunch of numbers in his head, and the president, it's clear that this president is not a policy wonk of the nature that Clinton was.
Or so even John Kerry.
Trying to remember various numbers, and I think he just remembered a number that was his promise rather than what was actually delivered.
Or according to Dave Lindorf of Salon.com, maybe someone was whispering in his ear through that contraption in his jacket. Let me read on to what Vince says. He goes on to say, how about allowing people to come into this country to work for minimum wage? That to me is unbelievable. Not only are we going to outsource jobs, but we'll allow people to come into the country and take them and help keep the wages down. I thought Kerry won them all, but was less impressed last night. Well, let me deal with those two issues, I think, in Vince's question. One is an immigration issue about people coming in and pushing wages down, and the other is an outsourcing issue about businesses going abroad and using cheaper labor. It seems that, correct me if I'm wrong, on outsourcing abroad, Kerry definitely is on the side of workers. He doesn't want tax credits for outsourcing abroad. But when you talk about immigration here, I don't know. Is Bush's plan to have these temporary worker cards, that immigration plan, which lowers wages more, or Kerry's plan to let someone who's been here a long time, has worked and pays taxes, to get amnesty? Do they hurt American wages, these immigrants?
Well, you know, there's a lot of debate about that among economists. It's kind of hard to figure out what's the real impact. You got to think that lots of low-skill competition would put pressure on low-wage jobs in the U.S. I think that's pretty clear.
Okay.
The thing about the outsourcing, if you go look at the numbers, I do not believe outsourcing is nearly as big a deal as kind of its mind share. That said, if you are worried about outsourcing, Kerry has outlined a perfectly valid and defensible proposal of how to deal with that. And that is, it is true that the current tax code lets you move your stuff abroad and you don't ever have to pay tax until you bring the money back home. And so it gives you this incentive to go over there and just keep your money in Bermuda for as long as you can and put off paying taxes, and it gives you a little subsidy to do so.
So when Kerry says that Bush is actually giving taxpayer benefits to people who take jobs abroad...
Yeah, there is an element of truth to that.
All right.
And he was quite correct. Kerry was quite correct in the debate last night when he said they just passed this new corporate tax bill, and it actually makes the problem worse rather than fixing it. That is true. It gives these special amnesties where you're going to give people a special incentive to go do this, you know, in a one-time situation to get in before the law expires. So I believe that is a perfectly sensible way to deal with the issue of outsourcing. Now, Kerry was also realistic, and what he said I totally agree with, and that is nothing is going to stop outsourcing in general. It's just a question of, are we going to level the playing field? And I actually think if you were going to try to stop all outsourcing, it would be dangerous. There are things that we should keep trying to move up the ladder, the wage ladder, if you will, and send low-wage things abroad. The question is, are we moving up the wage ladder? And I think the part that is disturbing about how the economy is progressing this time is the growth is very good, productivity growth is very good, but the labor market has been really substandard. So job growth, even on the president's terms, if you just say, forget about the original loss of the jobs, and he says, okay, in the last 2 years, we've added 1.5 million. The thing that he doesn't point out is that in all previous recoveries, we added way, way more than 1.5 million.
Clinton
even
added
the president's
22 million over 8 years.
Forecasts were that by this point, we were going to have added 7 million. Okay, so, and this is as of 2002, so they fully knew that we were in recession at that time. And they said, okay, based on past recoveries, by the time of the election, we'll probably have added 7 million jobs.
Well, Professor Goolsbee, bottom line here, because I really want to get this straight, because George Bush is the first president since Herbert Hoover, the first president since the Great Depression to have lost jobs during his presidency.
Yeah,
all the
true.
Other presidents, we've had World War II, we've had Vietnam, we've had the great oil shocks of the 1970s, the horrible inflation of Jimmy Carter. None of them lost jobs under their watch. Now, the Republicans will tell you, and I've had them on my show again and again, and they say 9/11 lost us 1 million jobs or more, and it was a unique occurrence, and it's not Bush's fault at all. It's just sheer accident, sheer coincidence. This occurred on his watch, that Clinton was already leading us toward recession, and Bush cannot be blamed for this loss of jobs. What's your position on that?
Well, look, everything that you said in the prelude to that final question is true. We've had presidents who went through some very difficult circumstances, and on net, at the end of their terms, they had not lost jobs. So that is very notable. Now, that said, the jobs number is not really under the control of the president. There's not a lever in the White House basement where they could go in and say, hey, well, let's just switch this thing to high and then we'll start creating jobs.
Not directly under the control, but the president can do things indirectly.
Relevant, look, it is true that typical voters evaluate the president on how well is the economy doing. And by that measure, the growth is solid, the jobs growth is not solid, and the wage growth, which is what I've been trying to emphasize a bit more important than just the jobs growth, is even if you're creating jobs, something like 85% of the job creation is taking place in two sectors, and those are fast food restaurants and temp services, employment services, and those are not high wage jobs. So if you saw Kerry quoting numbers that said the wages in the jobs being created are some more than $10,000 a year less than the jobs that are going away. That, I think, is disturbing. And that is where you would want to, you'd say, okay, the economy's doing this. The president's not doing that. Something happened. Say 9/11, say recession, what have you. Now, how does the president react to that? How can we minimize that? And there you could use the tax code, for example, to try and increase jobs. Kerry's proposed that manufacturing jobs credit. You could go argue with the Chinese about currency, saying, the dollar's too inflated relative to the Chinese currency, so we can't export anything. That's perfectly good strategy. And the Bush people really didn't do any of those things.
Professor
Goldsmith, that's where they can get criticized.
I want to talk a little about economics. I want to put it in a way that people can understand.
Yeah.
But I'm an economics major. I graduated economics, magna cum laude from Harvard.
That's not good.
Have a doctorate like you do, so I definitely defer to you. But let me talk some basic economics here. They teach you in economics class that generally, all things being equal, it's one of those favorite things that economists say, all things being equal, and of course all things are never equal, but all right, all things being equal, usually you either have wages go down and jobs go up,
right?
If wages are lower, labor's cheaper, so more people can work, or you have jobs go down as labor goes up.
Right.
And so that you're okay. In this administration, we've had both jobs go down and wages go down. Let me finish making my argument. Usually, if you look at economic theory, when you have a war, a war helps the economy. All this great spending. Some people argue, in fact, it wasn't the New Deal that got FDR out of the recession. It was World War II. A war helps the economy. We certainly had a war. Furthermore, if you look at government spending, economic theory will tell you that the more fiscal spending you have, whether it's tax cuts or government spending, the more money you put in the economy spent by the government as you drive into debt, that makes the economy better off. And lastly, the last thing economists will tell you is that monetary policy, which is how the Federal Reserve adjusts interest rates, basically, it's a little more complicated than that, but that's the heart of it. If they lower interest rates, then that also helps the economy go, and the Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates to the lowest levels in the Bush administration since, I believe, 1960. So here we have the biggest fiscal policy ever. Huge amounts of government spending, putting us in a huge deficit. biggest amount of monetary policy in 40-something years, lowest interest rates ever. You've got a war going on. This is the kind of stuff, this is like putting an economist, if I were to take my economics exam and they were to ask me what were to happen when those three things happened, I would say it's like putting a match in gasoline. The economy should roar.
They really spiked the punch on that one. Look, you make a good point. That
and yet
true.
We have lower jobs and lower wages. So
yeah,
either economic theory is bunk, which I don't think you or I agree with, or George Bush is doing something particularly wrong to apply all these economic levers, and our economy, instead of a match to gasoline, is sputtering like trying to make a car go. And my view, and again, I'm going to throw it out there, and you feel free to disagree. I like when people disagree with me. That's fine. My theory is that because the tax cuts were so overwhelmingly weighted toward the rich, because they were backloaded, they're not here today, they're being spent in the future, and because they're being spent on things like inheritance tax, which is a huge amount of money that basically encourages rich people to die, which doesn't really help the economy, and instead of lowering taxes like Social Security taxes, sales taxes, state and local taxes, the taxes that poor and middle class people struggling to make a living pay, instead of helping kids get Pell Grants for education, that basically when you take the tax burden and you make rich people pay less and middle class people pay more, they are the engines of the economy. And that's at least my theory as a graduate with an economics degree but not a doctorate. That's my theory as to why Bush, despite pulling out all the stops, our economy's sputtering along. How do you like my theory?
I'm not sure if I totally agree with your theory, but I do think you are onto something. And that is, the economy is performing strangely in this recovery. Okay, we have a recession. By most measures of the recession, it was a mild recession. Okay, so if you go back and look at 1982, that was a very deep recession.
Or 74, it was far worse.
Yeah, it was really quite bad. And then what you tend to see after a recession is very robust growth. This time, you don't see that. You see this mild recession, though the job performance is as if it were a bad recession. And then you see this recovery, somewhat robust, almost no or very small increase in jobs. So you got a net loss of jobs, while at the same time, wages are going down, which is, as you point out, strange. You add this heavy fiscal stimulus, very loose monetary policy, and you say, what in the world is going on?
You got 2 minutes to explain.
Okay. So the thing is, your theory is Bush did it. My theory is Bush did not do it. There are things going on that did it, but Bush reacted badly to it.
My theory is Bush
is
part of it.
He should be doing things to alleviate the burden on the middle class, and he didn't. On the war, I think what you got is this war is very different from other wars. It's not like World War II where you say, okay, let's go build a lot of machinery. Let's go pay Ford to convert their plant and make airplanes. What you got is a bunch of troops, you know, calling up the National Guard, people who had regular jobs, take them out of their jobs, send them to Iraq to, you know, stand around as a target. They're not building anything. That's not a big increase in demand here at home. I think that's why the war hasn't really done anything.
Okay. All right. So the answer is that Bush didn't cause some of this, but he could have fixed it.
Yeah, I think he could have responded much better.
My feeling is that Bush has, as if you will, poured a whole bunch of gasoline in the wrong car.
Yeah.
And a few drops may have sputtered in our economy and made it go a little bit. But I mean, again, getting rid of the inheritance tax, I don't know how anyone can argue that people work harder because rich people, when they die, can leave $100 million to their child. It makes absolutely no sense. We're spending all this money and we're putting it in the wrong place. But that's going to have to be the final word. Thank you very much, Dr. Goolsbee, for coming on
for
the program. I really enjoyed it. I do want to respond. I got 2 minutes left. Now that I Dr. Goolsbee's off the air, I do want to talk about the mention of Dick Cheney. Daughter, because some of you have, they've challenged me and Carrie on it. Let me read a comment from James. James writes, I really wish Carrie had left Cheney's daughter out of it. I don't know what that was about. It was one thing for Edwards to talk about it with Cheney. It is completely another thing to bring it up as a plain example. I would go as far as to say it was almost like Bush trying to exploit McCain's daughter back in the primary. Actually, James, I couldn't disagree with you more. I like that you contribute a lot, but I disagree with you on this one, friend. Look, it seems to me that the Republicans really have this squeamishness when it comes to gay people. They just don't want to talk about it. You look at the whole don't ask, don't tell thing, which came from conservatives. Clinton agreed to it wrongly, but it came from conservatives. The whole idea is that gay people should stay in the closet. They shouldn't say who they are because it just makes people upset. John Kerry, I think it was very important to give a real-life example and to show that in every family, there are gay people. The question to George Bush, the question to John Kerry was, is being gay a choice? And anyone who knows any gay people knows it's simply not a choice. People don't choose their sexual orientation. And if they did, certainly the daughter of the right-wing Vice President of the United States would not have chosen to be gay. I thought it was a fair example, and I think it's interesting that they call foul. Maybe Republicans believe that being gay is something like alcoholism or drug use that you shouldn't talk about, but Democrats believe it's something you should talk about, just like we talk about race, just like we talk about religion. There was a time when you wouldn't mention, oh no, that someone is black and wants to do something. Look, mentioning McCain's child, which by the way was, I don't remember if it was a daughter or son, but I know it's an adopted child from Bangladesh, and complaining, suggesting that Cheney had an illegitimate affair with a black woman to have a black baby in South Carolina, that is dirty politics. It's a lie, for one thing, and it suggests that McCain did something wrong. In this case, Dick Cheney did nothing wrong. He simply has a gay daughter, which is common throughout America. And I think that Kerry was making a larger point. Gay people are everywhere. Hey, some of them even do radio shows. And the way it is it's the difference between believing that all Americans are equal and there's nothing to be ashamed of, and George Bush, who suggests at best, gay people should be tolerated. And John Kerry's making the point, it's not a question about toleration. It's a question about equal rights for everyone. I'm glad that John Kerry mentioned Cheney's daughter. I think it's absolutely right. But you know, if you disagree with me, post to the blog, tell me I'm wrong. That's what free speech is all about. Hey, tomorrow's show is going to be great. We're going to talk about Sinclair Broadcasting, what they're trying to do with their anti-Kerry screed, why I think they should be boycotted. And then Sunday, we go into Republican dirty tricks. We're going to explore the question of whether, hey, George Bush has got some fancy contraption between his shoulder blades. My guest, who's Dave Lindorf of Salon.com, he believes that George Bush really does have something to hide. And we're also going to talk about some of the voting that's going on, where they're actually in Arizona and Las Vegas throwing the votes away, the voter registration forms, I should say, away of Democrats. It's happening in Florida, too. That's Sunday's Inside Scoop at 6 o'clock. I'll see you tomorrow for another edition of the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine, signing off.